Radio Prague News.
The government is to discuss the purchase of new Javelin missiles and radars. The Green Party is putting the focus on marijuana and a shorter work week. More than 90% of Czechs fear that European security will be threatened in coming years. The Czech Army is planning to purchase new radars and American-made anti-tank missiles, according to the Czech news agency, reporting Monday. The deal will be discussed by the government this week. Defense Ministry spokesman Petr Medek said the equipment and missiles would bolster the country's military capabilities on foreign missions. The Javelin anti-tank missiles under consideration have automatic self-guidance and lock-on before launch. The planned purchase of the missiles, plus other equipment, is expected to come to more than 500 million crowns. The Green Party will push for legislative changes such as the legalization of the growing of marijuana for both health and recreational use, as well as, with rising effectivity, a shorter work week. This according to the party's new policy program agreed at the weekend. Party chairwoman Jana Drapalová made clear that Germany and Denmark were a source of inspiration for the party, which served in a center-right government led by Mirek Topolánek back in 2006. In elections in 2010 and 2013, however, the Greens did not get enough votes to make it into the Chamber of Deputies. More than 90% of Czechs fear that European security will be threatened over the next 20 years, a new poll by the STEM agency suggests. A similar number said that the threat was likely to come from the East, while three-quarters of Czechs said the EU needed to do more in defense. The poll was conducted before terrorist attacks in Paris. The results of the poll contrast sharply with one from 2007, when 62% feared a threat to Europe compared to the 93% now. Police checked some 1,500 drinking establishments in the second wave of an operation to curb underage drinking across the country. This time, officers detained 287 minors, 51 more than in the month of October. The news was released by the spokeswoman for the police presidium on Monday. Extra checks of venues are to continue until the end of the year. Many Czech cultural, academic and professional institutions are due to mark the 700th anniversary of the birth of the famous Czech monarch Charles IV next year. Details of the program were unveiled Monday. The National Gallery will present a unique series of exhibits in the sphere of culture and arts focusing on his day, the gallery's director Jiří Fajt said. The government is likely to sponsor projects by providing funding of around 90 million crowns. Although a final sum has not yet been approved, it is clear it will not be near the proposed original limit of 250 million. Organizers on Monday also revealed the official logo. Czech singer Daniel Landa has cancelled a tour which had been scheduled in major cities across the Czech Republic next year, citing security reasons. He made the announcement at a press conference, suggesting he could not justify bringing together large groups of people at concerts, as details about his involvement in an alleged secret project emerged. The singer claimed he had worked for the last 7 years with members of the international Afghan community fighting Islamic State. He said he was due to consult details with Czech politicians and the intelligence services. The Gulag Online Museum, presenting a 3D reconstruction and virtual tour of the former Soviet labor camp system, will be launched by the Czech Association Archipelago in March or April of 2016. Its head Štěpán Černošek told the Czech news agency. The aim of the project is to allow internet users to learn more about the infamous system and specific sites on the internet. I'm Jan Wellinger. You'll find more news at radio.cz.
You are listening to Radio Prague, the international service of Czech Radio, with me, Ruth Franíková. Coming up in today's program, the Czech Republic joins global negotiations over a deal to curb climate change. Can the Czech Republic's biggest power company meet the Paris climate challenges? And we have the summary of the latest Czech sports news. Later in One-on-One, we meet Tomáš Bísek, a Protestant cleric who was a dissident in communist Czechoslovakia and was eventually forced to leave the country. All that coming up, so please stay with us. Close to 150 world leaders have descended on Paris for a much-anticipated UN climate change conference with the aim of producing a legally binding climate treaty that would keep global temperatures from rising more than 2 degrees Celsius. The EU's contribution to the agreement will be a binding greenhouse gas emissions reduction target of at least 40% by 2030. Daniela Lazarova has the details.
Czech Prime Minister Bohuslav Sobotka joined heads of state and government in Paris on Monday for a climate change conference that is to make a significant impact in curbing global warming and for the first time ever produce a treaty that would include both the big industrial players and the developing states. The Czech Republic's position is already given by an agreement reached within the European Union. Pavel Zamyslitsky, head of the Climate Change Department at the Environment Ministry, is a member of the Czech delegation to Paris.
For the Czech Republic, of course, it's the most important to achieve an agreement in Paris, to have a long-term global agreement which would be fair and stable and which would include all parties, all participants, of course, in order to reach 2 degrees Celsius target. The EU leaders agreed in October 2014 to have a 40% target by 2030. So it means this target is binding as well for the Czech Republic.
And aid to the developing world, which obviously is crucial, a crucial element in making this work.
Of course, it's necessary to help finance different adaptation and mitigation measures and projects in developing countries, especially in the poorest one. So it's necessary to help them through the Green Climate Fund, through different bilateral and multilateral channels. So it's necessary to mobilize private and as well public financial sources in order to help them to mitigate and adapt to climate change impacts.
While the Czech branch of Greenpeace has expressed doubts as to whether the Czech Republic can meet its environmental commitments without changing its long-term energy policy, it says the EU agreement dating back to October 2014 has forced the country to accept a greater share of responsibility than at any time in the past. Even so, Jan Rovensky of Greenpeace says that alongside its verbal commitment to helping the developing countries, the Czech Republic will need to increase the size of its annual financial contribution as well. As regards the chances of seeing a binding agreement reached in Paris, Jan Rovensky says that he is not overly optimistic.
It's very hard to estimate the outcomes of the conference, but with the current position of all parties, I am quite skeptical of the real final legally binding deal in the Paris. The good news could be that in the Kyoto conference a couple of years ago, the original feeling was very similar, and finally there was a deal. So there's still some chance that there will be some outcome.
Jan Rovensky of Greenpeace, ending that report by Daniela Lazarova. If the Paris Climate Change Summit delivers on ambitious goals and targets, then the main burden will fall on energy companies to deliver on them. But is the Czech Republic's biggest power company, ČEZ, placed to square up to that challenge? Chris Johnston has more.
Around three-quarters of all greenhouse gas emissions in the Czech Republic are created by the broad energy sector. That's energy use across the board, from energy production to energy use by industry and transport. Basic energy production accounts for half of those emissions, with the transport and manufacturing sectors weighing in at about 15% each. So the energy sector will bear the brunt of whatever climate change commitments are eventually earmarked for the Czech Republic as part of the bigger undertakings from the European Union. State-controlled power company ČEZ is far and away the dominant energy producer in the country, generating around 70% of power from a mix of renewable, coal-fired and nuclear power plants. But just under half of its power output comes from plants burning lignite or brown coal, and most of the rest comes from its two nuclear power plants at Dukovany and Temelin. Wind, solar, hydro and gas-fired power plants account for less than 10% of its production. ČEZ has largely backed the European Union's long-term energy goals, framed with a view to the Paris summit. In particular, it's looking for a much stronger emissions trading system, which will give clear and substantial rewards to companies which deliver cuts in output of climate change gases. So how easily will it be for ČEZ to live with the low-carbon economy of the next decades and longer? That's a question put to Petr Hlinomaz, an analyst with the Prague-based brokerage BH Securities, who follows ČEZ developments and strategy.
I think that there will be no problem, because at first the Paris summit might bring very important but very general conclusions, and Europe from this point of view is in advance from the protection of the climate. So CES and other energy companies had to respond to the new circumstances. So from this point of view, I think that there will be no problem, but CES has a very low emission production portfolio, which is an advantage.
That's a low carbon footprint compared, say, with the heavy co-burning companies in Poland, but not so clean compared with the energy revolution which Germany has embarked on. Big energy companies, with their profits already undermined by low electricity prices, are generally cautious about any new undertakings. CES and other big European energy players have stressed they will need help to cover the costs of research and development on low-carbon technologies. At the same time, they're worried about the possible evolution of a new energy market, not based on a handful of very big players delivering power across countries and continents, but on hundreds of small power companies just delivering to local villages and towns, which might leave them high and dry. Petr Hlinomaz again.
I think that these big companies feel that conditions and circumstances are changing, so they are trying to make acquisition of photovoltaic companies, of producers of the energy solution, etc., and to create the dependence of customers.
Petr Hlinomaz of the Prague-based brokerage BH Securities, ending that report by Chris Johnston. But now I am joined in the studio by Ian Willoughby with a summary of the latest Czech sports news.
We begin today with winter sports, and the Czech Republic's biathlonists have just returned to action after an 8-month break. And a fine return it was too, with the country's mixed relay team coming third at a World Cup event in Sweden's Östersund on Sunday. Indeed, Veronika Vítková, Gabriela Sokalová, Michal Schlesinger and Andrej Moravec finished a mere 11 seconds behind the victorious Norwegians. Coach Andrej Rybář is the man credited with the recent golden era of Czech biathlon. But he says the team's great performance at the weekend, including a notable return to form for Sokalová, doesn't necessarily mean we can expect more collective or individual success this season.
We start every season with the mixed relay, but it's a specific event and completely different. It's followed by individual distance competitions where there really is a lot of competition. From Sunday's race, we can see that more competitors have emerged who will be pushing to reach the top. The season will be even closer than last season, I think.
Downhill skier Šárka Strachová has just enjoyed her best start to the Alpine Skiing World Cup since way back in 2009. The former Šárka Záhrobská finished fourth and third in her first two slalom events of the season at the US resort of Aspen at the weekend, describing her placings on Facebook as an excellent first step. The 30-year-old former world champion had been in second place after the first round on Sunday, before being leapfrogged by Frida Hansdotter of Sweden in the next. Strachová, who is third overall in the World Cup standings, will next compete in Sweden's Åre on December the 13th. Ice hockey, and after a dreadful start to the season, reigning Extraliga champions Litvinov have just sacked assistant coach Andrei Weissmann. However, head coach Radim Rulík remains in place at Litvinov, who on Sunday lost 1-4 to Karlovy Vary. After 23 rounds, the champions are stuck firmly to the foot of the table. Liberets, who are top, made light work of Zlín in a 5-1 victory on Sunday, and second-placed Pilsen overcame Trinets 3-2 after penalties. Off the ice, Chomutov are in hot water after their masseur, František Moščič, allegedly attacked a Kometa Brno player with a stick and fought with another after a game on Friday. Chomutov have apologised but can still expect a stiff fine over the incident. Finally, soccer, and reigning Czech league champion Sparta Prague made a 67 million crown loss last season, according to a report in the magazine Euro. Despite the club going into the red, that was the third best result achieved since tycoon Daniel Křetínský took over as owner in 2004. Indeed, Sparta Prague have lost over 1 billion crowns since then. They've only made a profit once in the last 11 years, and that was the year after Křetínský took the reins. That's all the sport for today.
Just a reminder that you are listening to Radio Prague, the international service of Czech radio. It was difficult to be a cleric in communist Czechoslovakia, but some people continued to serve their churches as best they could, despite pressures from the party. Among them was the now retired Protestant clergyman Tomáš Bísek, who is Ian Willoughby's guest in this week's edition of One on One.
Protestant cleric Tomáš Bísek was forced to leave Czechoslovakia in the 1980s for his dissident activities and spent over a decade ministering in Scotland. His family had been active members of the Evangelical Church of Czech Brethren, and despite the communist regime, he himself had eventually become a clergyman in a small town in the Bohemian Moravian Highlands. However, his life became increasingly difficult after he and his wife signed the Charter 77 protest document. I began the first half of a two-part interview by asking Mr. Bísek, who was born in 1939, what he recalled of World War II.
I clearly remember that we lived in Dobeška, which is really a little hill. You see the river and the Prague in the distance, and there was a danger during Prague uprising that they bombarded this part of Prague by the Germans. So we moved to the bank of the Prague. I remember the tanks, you know, shelling, light shells. That was first. And the second was back to this lovely house when we could see Prague, and when the Prague was bombarded by Allies, really very, very end of the war. Emmaus monastery was really in flames. I remember that very clearly, you know. And later when there was the parades with rockets and this, you know, what you call it, wonderful.
Fireworks?
Fireworks. In my memory, I always combined it with this horrifying events of the end of the Prague. I never enjoyed it, in fact.
To jump forward slightly, you first graduated from the Czech Technical University.
Yes.
But did you always want to minister, or was that something that came later?
Not clearly. In fact, with my mother, who was awfully strict in a sort of formal religious way, I always suffered to take the services or Sunday school, whichever. I really hated it. But it was really due to the actions of, let's say, party or teachers that slowly I felt awkward with the system. And it was actually during the study at the Technical University we had, part of the program was Marxism, Leninism and all this stuff. And we had a few weeks ago, we had a 53rd anniversary meeting with some colleague of mine, and they said, Tomáš, you always were called by us as an individual, because through these discussions with the lecturer of the Marxism Leninism, he said, what about the individual person? What's his role in this way? So it grew through me during that time, and after studying a year of work in the factory and then army conscript, at that time I realized that the numbers for the Faculty of Theology Studies were so limited, officially, I would say, by the party. Then I said, perhaps I could do something with it, and applied for the study, and miraculously was accepted with the condition that I would take not just an evening or whichever, but full course. So I spent years and years of studying after Technical University, another 5 years, something which is probably normal now, but in those days it was very unusual.
Well, the 1960s was a relatively liberal time in Czechoslovakia, but I'm still curious how much freedom would religious communities have had in that period?
I think that there was a situation slowly getting closer to Prague Spring, and it was in people's minds. In fact, as we recognized that we should break the chains, the pressure and counter-pressure moving on and off. And in fact, I only later, after everything happened and Russians tanks rolled the streets of Prague, I realized how lucky we were to be, having lived that time through the period approaching to Prague Spring.
And you also studied in America at that time. How was that possible?
Yes, a year after at the end of the studies of theology, it was 69, a year after the invasion. A group of ours were invited to study abroad. I think the intention of the system was that let them go, they would never come back. Almost everyone actually returned. And an invitation came from Professor Lochmann, a systematics, who was a visiting professor at the Union Theological Seminary in New York. My wife and the daughter joined me later, and everything was quite possible. But the return was different, of course.
Well, after you came back, you were a clergyman in Telezi in the Wysocina, and both you and your wife, Daniela, signed Charter 77 in 1977. What prompted you both to sign that? You must have known that there was a price you would pay for signing it.
It was a process which, in certain ways, started immediately after my return. I couldn't get the state license, as you perhaps everyone knows. No one could act as a clergyman without state license. It was the precondition without it you couldn't. And the clerk, regional clerk of the East Bohemian region, declared Mr. Bisek unwanted. And it was the leading moderator, the head of the Evangelical Church, fortunately, the man who studied in the States prior to the war, old man, who challenged him on the level of Ministry of Culture and eventually got the invitation. It was interesting when he said, but Mr. Bisek was invited and the ministry gave him permission and he returned rightly back to help us. So what's the problem? But later I realized that they never stopped keeping an eye on me. And from 1975-76, there was a first row of interrogations regarding my contacts abroad, the friends, activities, and content of my preaching and actions, plus the fact that people who assigned for religious classes at the local primary school were officially invited to the local mayor office and the director of the school and were warned that those who assigned the children, they would have complicated problems later regarding the studies and jobs. I protested many a time, I would say, and eventually when we got the Charter 77 document, we immediately agreed, both of us, my wife and I, but we would be still worried. But then we saw the list of the first signatories. I recognized some of my close friends from the studies and others who were already facing problems. I said, let's multiply the number of signatories as quick as possible.
I've read some comments from people who signed Charter saying that it was a kind of relief, a kind of line in the sand.
Surely so.
And that from that point, you were in a way free because you had declared yourselves.
Yes. Suddenly the scene was really black and white. You free yourself from all this pressure.
I've often read also that the dissident movement was a kind of broad church with many different kinds of people in it, including disappointed reform communists, strong anti-communists, clerics like yourself. Was it really so harmonious, the dissident world?
I wouldn't call it harmonious in intimacy of some people who, under pressure, there could have been family tensions or colleagues tensions, but regarding the aim or something, we were really walking together. So much so that only through these years, suddenly I found myself in close contacts, which we keep up to date with reformed communists or playwrights or whoever. So that was fantastic. From those times, I recognized that it's like with the refugees now, that it's not clear from certain walks of life that people recognize what it means to be a human being and how much to help. But there is a sort of cross-section through a variety of professions and careers or whichever, that people suddenly free themselves from the pressure and say, this is what I want to do. This is where I want to help.
People say also that it was harder, perhaps much harder, to be a dissident in the countryside than in Prague. People were more isolated. Would you vouch for that?
Yeah, very much so. On the other hand, I can say maybe 25 interrogations. I think I was somehow sheltered by the fact that I was, till 1982, I was safe from physical problems or whichever, but warnings, you know, multiplied. And the fact that in 1979, I found the bags in the ceiling, the microphones, that, of course, was clear declaration of the war. But the police, when they came to the village, sometimes they didn't want me to know that they were there. But it was people working in the field, they recognized them straight on because they maneuvered their cars as if they were in the city. Obviously, they were trained in a big city. Can you imagine a village with 800 people? And the car one stop on one place, then 100 yards further on the next day, the same car. Mr. Bisek, Tomas, the minister, they are there, a glass house.
I was reading that the STB file on you was called Samota, meaning solitude.
Yeah.
Was that a fitting name?
I don't know how they got it, really. It was never really a Samota. But the old party member who started with the interrogation and at the end of his career, he would call the Manzintelezi a hotel because it was used during the war as a hotel for the partisan movement. But Samota, in fact, I think they recognized that there were people moving from Prague or from Brno, because it was halfway between these two larger cities meeting there. Sometimes we had really for the weekend quite a number of people.
And would you have had people whose names would be well known today visiting you?
Like Hanna Šabatová, you know, or Peter Uhl, Václav Malý.
Bishop.
Yes, these were the people. Jaroslav Šabata as well.
Next week, in the second half of this two-part interview, Tomáš Bisek describes the joys and difficulties of serving as a clergyman in Scotland and his return to the Czech Republic in the mid-1990s. And that brings us to the end of our English language broadcast. If you have any comments about today's programme, then please send them to us. You can contact us by email at english@radio.cz or on Facebook and Twitter. We'll be glad to hear from you. But that's all for now from me, Ruth Franková. Thank you very much for joining us, and goodbye.